welcome to another episode of Science Chat, the Science Communication Podcast. I'm Sean Marshall. Today I'm speaking with Sean Duke, who presents the science show Science Spin on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Sean is also editor of the Science Spin magazine.
Sean, tell us about your radio show, Science Spin. What's the format of the show and what kind of things do you cover?
Well, at the moment, it's changed a little bit because I'm now, it's on the go about a year and a half. And, you know, no more than yourself, the idea really is to try and popularize science with a general audience. So I've changed it a little bit from having three segments down to two. And the reason is that with the two, it's a half hour show. You get about 12 minutes with each interviewee, so you can go into things in a little bit more detail. I suppose the core audience is the science community in Ireland, and I've a list of people there, maybe about 500 or so, that get it each time it goes out. But, you know, it's obviously aimed at a wider audience as well.
Is it science news or is it debating about science?
Right. Well, again, when I started, it was kind of debating. But then what it's evolved into, if you like, is I've two segments now, really, that I call one The Question Is. And I call the other one, What's It All About? And the idea with The Question is that I pose a question that I think is a very interesting one in science to an expert. And we debate that and we discuss it and we flesh it out. Like, for example, recently I had somebody on talking about dark matter, you know, and dark energy, this stuff that's out there in the universe that we can't see. And people don't know exactly what it is or where it is. Because, as you know yourself, probably that gravity indicates that 96% of the universe, which is an awful lot of the stuff out there, we just can't see it.
Yeah.
You might have something about parallel universes. Do they exist? What are they? So that would be The Question Is. And then What's It All About would be a more general thing where you would, for example, recently I had Chris Bean on from UCD, who's a volcanologist. And he was talking about volcanoes and, you know, we know what a volcano is, but what does science know at the moment about volcanoes? So it'd be, what's it all about? The topic would be volcanoes for that particular issue. And then just as we're changing between the first and the second guest, there's a little kind of a 2-minute thing there where you have to key up the next guest. So basically in there, I'll select something that just caught my eye in the science news of the week. It could be something to do in Ireland that's happening in Ireland, or it could be something in the States or whatever. And I just call it Did You See? And I just chat about that, something that I think might have an impact on society into the future, typically, you know.
Okay. And what's the breakdown between your live listenership and your podcast listeners? Because very often the shows that are on, that the nationwide broadcasters have, the show is the primary vehicle and the podcast is very much a secondary for maybe people that didn't catch the show. Would the podcast be more important for a show like yours?
It possibly would. I'm not, to be honest with you, they don't have audience figures in Dublin City FM. So the general listenership at the time for the live show, I don't really know what it is. I mean, I don't know what the numbers are. All I do know is what my podcast is doing, and it's kind of interesting because although there's a fair amount of listeners, you can geo tag them and stuff like that on Podomatic, which is the website I use for my thing. A lot of them are in the Greater Dublin area. Most of them in Ireland are in the Greater Dublin area. I'd like to have more listeners outside the Greater Dublin area, but quite a lot in Dublin and some dotted around the country, of course. But quite a lot, surprisingly, from China. Now, I don't know whether that has to do with, I've got enormous numbers of downloads on occasion from China, where you could have, you know, 150 downloads in 2 hours. So I don't know what that's, and you can actually, which is fascinating with Podomatic, you can trace that on a map, on a Google map, to an actual building, you know, in Beijing where these downloads are happening, which is very interesting. So all I can think of is that maybe there's students in China that are coming to Ireland to study science and they want to maybe practice their English as well. And they're looking for something on the net that's going to give them that. And maybe that's why they come to my show.
Yeah, it wasn't that particular topic had anything that might be of interest in China or anything.
No, I mean, the topics are very generic, you know. Very occasionally, though, I must say, there would be something that would relate specifically to Irish science. But my show is of a very broad, like volcanoes. I mean, you could have anybody in the world interested in that, or dark matter, dark energy, or what. And I've done that deliberately. So you will get listeners from all over the place when you take that approach. I deliberately didn't want to have it parochial, as in, you know, there's somebody in Cork doing something, or there's somebody in wherever doing something else. If there's an Irish connection, of course, I'll mention it. And more often than not, the guests are Irish. But the topics are of a broad nature, you know.
I use Podomatic myself as well, and I actually don't have that many listeners in the greater Dublin area, but mine is very much pitched at an international audience anyway, and quite a lot of the people I interview would be from overseas.
It's kind of hit and miss, isn't it, really? Because you might have some research institute that picks up on something if you're tagging your shows with a particular topic or whatever, then that obviously influences the searches. So a lot of it might be just luck. If they like your show, then they'll subscribe and keep listening. So, you know, that's the great thing about the internet.
Yeah, and talking about the internet, I mean, there are such a lot of science podcasts available, and that they're only produced as podcasts. And do you think that radio as a medium is still important for science now, even when there is such a large body of work out there that never gets exposure on the radio?
No, I think there's definitely a need, because while I try, obviously, part of what I do is to try and highlight the stuff that's going on in Ireland within the bigger picture, you know, I think what you're getting at is that really science isn't as high up the agenda, the media agenda, as it should be. And that's been the way in Ireland for a very long time. And I would have started writing as a science journalist. I would have started in the mid 90s, 95, 96, that kind of time. So that's 15, 16 years ago. And okay, there's a few small little changes that have happened. I mean, we've got there's a science show on News Talk. There's our own magazine, Science Spin. There's what you do. There's bits and pieces of the Irish Times. But really, we don't really have a tradition in Ireland, I think, of reporting science as part of the mainstream. It's always kind of pushed to one side or ghettoized in a way. Whereas really, even though the government, of course, is telling us all the time how important it is, it's. I don't think it's covered. You know, I think there's loads of room for more science coverage, basically, including radio.
Yeah, and of course, the national broadcaster has a responsibility as the public broadcasting service to promote science, even if there isn't a lot of national interest in it.
Exactly. Well, just one example on that, which I think is fascinating, is how there was a lot of talk. I remember hearing Mary Harney a few years ago talking at some event or other about the importance of science and promoting science in general, and in particular into schools, and how important television was as a medium. And, she said that really what was needed was a science correspondent for RT television. And I thought, this sounds good. Yeah, I agree with that. But then shortly after that, of course, there was an education and science correspondent. So as soon as education was put in there, of course, science is more or less dumped. Because as you know, the education and science coverage is, I would say, 95% education, 5% science, you know.
Yeah.
Science will only make it if there's something absolutely enormous happening.
Yeah, because education is going to be such a big thing anyway, and education is so linked to finance and, well, really everything that's going on with the government. So it'll all actually probably come back to politics in the end. And
exactly. It comes back down to a kind of an industrial relations type story where there's, you know, the teachers conference, or maybe there's various hassles going on or whatever. But science doesn't get a look in anyway.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that came to mind, particularly over the last month or so, with regard to national radio stations and how they deal with science, even if they're not dealing with it through a science program, was to do with the quality of the science reporting relating to the Japanese earthquake disaster, and most importantly, the subsequent nuclear danger that is now present in Japan, and certainly in the area around those nuclear reactors. How do you think that they dealt with the science involved? You know, not just from a science correspondent point of view, but even from the point of view of the current affairs reporting?
I didn't think it was great, I have to be honest. And I don't think you have an excuse in terms of resources. I mean, I don't think they explained. And this was a story where you really had to have, you couldn't ignore the science. The science was central. Like, you couldn't talk about the story without talking about the science. And really, that science wasn't explained. So there was a big opportunity missed there. Like, they did have their correspondent in Japan. But then, you know, what happened, what seemed to happen was that you'd be interviewing older Japanese people or people who've lost their house. And that's fine. You need that. But you also need, people want to know what the hell's going on here. What's happening with the reactor? How does a reactor work in the first place? You know, when they say meltdown, what does that mean? What are these cooling rods? All of these things are just thrown out there and they're not explained. Now, I think the British, again, they were far better. Now, I thought Sky were quite good on the nuclear story, because they, I don't know if you saw some of the stuff, but the way they present it on the big wall behind the presenter, and they have somebody who's an expert talking about what's actually happening, and then there's graphics.
Yeah.
Now, they have the resources, but there wasn't even an attempt to do that. And you'd wonder, why was the correspondent sent to Japan at all?
You know, exactly.
That would have cost a lot of money, and really, they just put a microphone in front of a few Japanese people and ignored the science.
Yeah, and for that money, they probably could have done quite a good job on having a, you know, maybe one or two specials that they just produced in the studio, and get some of their own science people. They'd certainly be able to put a 30-minute program together which would explain how a reactor worked, what fuel rods were, what is the actual danger of radiation, what does it mean if there's a radiation leak, what's the difference between radioactive iodine, for instance, and cesium, why is one more dangerous in one way and one more dangerous in another way.
But even if an average intelligent person would be asking themselves, say somebody who's no background in science, because there was a tsunami story here, like, an obvious question would be, why were these things located on the sea? Why were they on the sea? Like, I don't think that even that was explained, you know, the need for the water and, you know, why that is part of the process, you know, the whole cooling thing, etc. You know, another bigger story that it wasn't even mentioned was, you know, why is Japan so keen on nuclear energy? And of course, we know because they have very few resources, natural resources like coal, nothing like that. And of course, this is one of the reasons maybe they went to war in the 1940s or 30s, all those years ago, to try and seize resources.
Yes.
When they rebuilt Japan, they wanted to be self-sufficient, and the only way they could do that was nuclear. So that you have to give people some background, and you have to explain the science, or else the story is kind of meaningless.
Absolutely. I also see from the Science Spin website, Sean, that you're involved with a training workshop entitled Speaking Science. Can you tell us some more about what this workshop involves and how it works?
Sure. Well, I've done workshops now, these workshops for different groups of people. I've done them in the universities. In Maynooth, I did one, a couple of them for PhD students in arts faculty, mixed in with science faculty, which was very interesting because they think so differently, and it worked out really well because they kind of learned from each other and were interested in each other. I guess the main thing that I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get scientists, or people that have to communicate science, to think in terms of how are we going, like what we were just talking about with the nuclear story. What are the questions that people want answered? How can we communicate this? Who are we trying to talk to here? Who's the audience? Is it the general public? Do you have to make a speech at some kind of a meeting? You know, whatever it is that they're trying to do in terms of their communication targets, that's what I'm trying to help them with from the perspective of somebody who's on the other side of the fence. Like, for example, the press release. This is a kind of a standard tool of communication. So I would go through some press releases that I've actually received, and why I think some of them work, and why I think a lot of them are absolutely dreadful. And then I show them how they should be rewritten. I basically give them my own experience as an editor for 10, 15 years, and what I think works in communication and what definitely doesn't work. So, you know, you've got the younger crowd coming through, the PhDs and the postdocs. I've had some senior people as well down in Galway at the, it's not the Marine Institute now, it's changed its name, but people there. And I've also done some with the business community, people that are involved in, say, business and industries that are related to science. Like, for example, Nova UCD, you know that place in UCD,
yeah,
which is startup companies. So a lot of the entrepreneurs there, I help them out. I hope I help them out anyway. And I really like it. I actually started out as a teacher before I was in journalism. So, you know, I enjoy teaching as well. So, you know, that's the goal of it anyway.
And have you found it to be successful? I mean, have you seen evidence of some of the people who've been through the course being improved in how they communicate science?
Yeah, well, it depends, because generally you have a half day or a full day. So you do your best, but, you know, there are limits on what you can achieve, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
But for example, people have said to me that at least now that they can write a press release, a basic press release, or they get some kind of perspective that isn't from a PR person on, you know, because scientists might have no idea, a lot of them, what makes up a story, what is a story, what's going to interest other people. That's not really clear in their head sometimes, you know, what it is they do that might be of interest and what really isn't of interest.
Yeah.
If at least the best thing you can get is to get them thinking about these things in a way that they didn't think before. And then, you know, they're all bright people, and then they just apply that. And, you know, I mean, if you had a week, you could do an awful lot more. But generally, as I say, it's a workshop of maybe 10 to 15 people over a day. So I should mention as well that, you know, this TCD UCD Innovation Academy.
Yeah. Well,
that's a very good initiative, I think, because, again, it's PhDs in Trinity and UCD, obviously, but I think they're going to extend it out to all over the country eventually. And they're arts graduates, they're history graduates, they're science graduates, and they're bringing them together to learn from each other, to try and think in different ways, to think innovatively. And I've been doing some communication stuff with them, which is challenging because I have to keep changing tack and keeping them interested. So I've done a few of those, which I really enjoy doing. I've done about three of them so far.
The only thing that we'll need now is to figure out some way of being able to educate the general public. We need to get the general public to have a more increased level of science literacy so they can understand what they're being told, really.
Yeah, well, say with the nuclear story, the problem then is that there's not an informed debate because, you know, despite what's happened in Japan, there may still be a case for nuclear power in Ireland, but we tend to operate in Ireland when it comes to, say, nuclear power or issues to do with incineration or issues to do with medical waste, that we have a very violent no reaction because we don't seem to trust the scientists if they're talking about nuclear power being a valid option, which a lot of them are in Ireland, actually. A lot of the physicists say maybe it is the way to go. We don't seem to trust the scientists. We're a little bit suspicious of them, whereas in other countries it's different. Maybe that's because a lot of people don't feel comfortable with it. They don't understand it well enough.
Yeah, and I sometimes wonder how much of that as well is that a lack of trust on our part of the regulators or the people who are in power, who are supposed to safeguard us. Because, I mean, obviously, you know, if you build either, whether it's an incinerator or a nuclear reactor, or even if it's a coal-fired power station, if you have proper checks and balances and the legislation is applied and the correct mechanisms are used for measuring the outputs, it minimizes the risk, or in some cases actually eliminates the risk. But I think in Ireland we found, and I mean our financial system is a classic example of this, we found that over the last number of years that I don't think we can trust that our own government or the regulatory bodies that they'll put in place will actually enforce the companies, yeah, who do either, whether it be incinerating or whatever else, to actually follow the legislation and make sure that it's safe.
Absolutely. And then you're dead right. I think that's a key point, because in the States, for example, I know that there's a high level of trust for their government, you know, for the EPA or for the nuclear authorities or for, say, the FDA that approves drugs,
yeah,
that people actually believe them. Whereas in Ireland, maybe we're right. You know, we think, God, there's so much going on now in Ireland in various different spheres that you'd wonder, you know, would they be up to regulating a nuclear industry where you can't make any mistakes?
Exactly. Exactly. And on that note, I'd like to thank you, Sean, for talking to us at Science Chat today.
Thanks very much for having me.
That's it for another episode of Science Chat. As usual, you can find out more details about this episode and other episodes on my blog, sciencechat.net/WordPress. Science Spin can be heard on 103.2 Dublin City FM every Thursday at 3:30 p.m. Irish time and is available for download on podcast as well. And you can find out more information about Sean, Science Spin and a speaking science course on the Science Spin website, www.sciencespin.com.